It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
14 Algerian soldiers killed in an ambush. The fate of missing Nigerian schoolgirls still unknown. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. 14 Algerian soldiers are dead after an attack late Saturday by suspected Islamist militants. The state news agency says the soldiers were ambushed in the mountainous Tizi Ouzou region while returning from security duties related to last Thursday's presidential election. Algeria fought a war against Islamist militants in the 1990s and continues to deal with periodic militant attacks. Last year, an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group attacked the Aminas natural gas plant, killing at least 40 foreign workers. The French press agency reports gunmen in northern Nigeria set fire to a staff residential building at a girls' secondary school Sunday, but the nearly 200 students in nearby dormitories were unharmed. The attack in Bauchi State came less than a week after suspected Islamist extremists kidnapped scores of schoolgirls in Borno State. Dozens of the girls have since escaped. And Look reports the military has come under criticism for saying nearly all the girls have been released shortly after their abduction last week.
Borno State Education Commissioner Musa Unoa Kubo told VOA the false report of the girls' release has only heightened their parents' impatience and apprehension.
When you come to the town and see all parents are in a mourning mood, everybody is sad in the sense that there was a glimpse of hope when it was announced that they have secured the release, and up to now they cannot see the children.
Local vigilante groups and hunters have set out on what defense headquarters says is a, quote, frantic search for the girls in the dangerous forest near the Cameroonian border, where the girls are believed to be held. The military is also looking. No one has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, though many are pointing to the militant Islamist sect Boko Haram, which has attacked other schools in the northeast. The group has also reportedly been abducting girls and young women to serve as spies, cooks, and servants. Boko Haram has killed thousands in northern Nigeria since 2009. The group says it wants to impose a harsh form of Islamic law, which would include banning all forms of Western education. And Look, VOA News, Dakar.
In South Sudan, no end to the fighting between government forces and rebels led by former Vice President Riek Machar, with violence reported at a UN base in Jonglei State, where an armed mob last week forced its way into the compound in Bor, killing 40. UNMISS peacekeepers opened fire at the mob and forced it back. The government's information minister has blamed UN personnel for opening fire first, provoking the violence. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports.
Tens of thousands of South Sudanese have sought shelter at UN bases across the country since violence broke out in December following a political rift between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar. In the latest fighting, opposition forces took over the town of Bentiu, capital of oil-producing Unity State. The government says the military soon will retake control. The lay says more than 6,000 civilians have fled to a UN base in Bentiu in recent days, bringing the total number of people taking shelter at the base up to 14,000.
The fear factor is driving people out of their homes into a very, very difficult sheltering conditions in the UN base.
The U.S. State Department Thursday issued a statement condemning the recent violence and has called on all sides involved in the conflict to adhere to a cessation of hostilities agreement signed in January. That agreement has been repeatedly violated while peace talks in the Ethiopian capital have stalled. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
In troubled Central African Republic Sunday, a pause in the sectarian violence that's gripped the nation as Christians marked Easter.
Avec les atrocités que nous avons vécues depuis plusieurs mois,
the curate of Bangui Cathedral, the Reverend Francis Sinclair Siki, said after the atrocities of the past few months, we reaffirm our faith in God who gave back life to a son who was dead, and he can also give life to those Central Africans who have died during recent events. The country has been in chaos since March of last year when mainly Muslim rebels seized power in a coup. Sectarian violence escalated amid mounting resentment toward the government led by the Muslim Salika Alliance. French and African peacekeepers are struggling to restore security to the country. In Libya, technical problems have delayed the reopening of the eastern Zuwaitina oil export terminal despite an agreement reached with militia who controlled the port, ending an 8-month blockade. Libya's justice minister says damage to the port during the standoff will keep it closed for the time being, while a second port in Hariga is still expected to open on time, two others at a later date. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. More can be found at our internet website, that address, voanews.com.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Monday, the 21st day of April, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan urges neighboring Sudan to stop attacks by armed groups.
We urge the Republic of Sudan allowing some of these Janjaweeds and others to come into unity state and cause havoc, in fact, is unacceptable.
Bana Bambarao Benjamin is South Sudan's foreign minister. President Joyce Banda of Malawi is confident she will win re-election on May 20th. The family of Liberia's deceased interim leader, Judith Bryant, has made known his wishes. And Egypt's May election is now between two candidates, but an analyst says it will be a sham election.
Basically, what you have is a situation, unfortunately, that one can say is very predictable because, in a sense, this is a sham election. It's not really a real election. And there is only one candidate that one can actually talk about as a real candidate.
Nizar Alseya is chair of the University of California Berkeley Center for Middle Eastern Studies. Somalia holds a security conference, and tomorrow is Earth Day, and a new firm looks at protecting the rainforest. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan's foreign minister said Juba has urged neighboring Sudan to prevent armed groups, including rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar, from cross-border attacks against South Sudan. Bana Bambarao Benjamin's comments came after South Sudan expressed concern that armed groups, including the Janjaweed and the Mensaria, crossed the border into South Sudan to launch attacks on its citizens and oil fields. Sudan denies the allegation, insisting that Khartoum does not interfere in South Sudan's internal affairs. South Sudan Foreign Minister Benjamin tells reporter Peter Clotty that Juba will keep its commitment to improve diplomatic and bilateral relations with Khartoum.
As far as we are concerned, because we know the government of the Republic of South Sudan is committed absolutely to cooperation agreement, which actually forms the basis for improving relations between Sudan and South Sudan. And then this agreement is a very important agreement because it guarantees the future of peace between the two countries. And therefore, any moves that undermines this agreement is actually spoiling the relations and making difficulties for the neighbors to move forward. This is why we urge the Republic of Sudan allowing some of these Janjaweeds and others to come into unity state and cause havoc, in fact, is unacceptable. They spoil relations. And I think that must be heeded to the Republic of Sudan.
One of the top-ranking officials of the Sudan's armed forces says that Sudan will not interfere in the internal affairs of South Sudan. There are other reports that some of the rebels are being trained in Sudan, recently attacking Bentiu. What is your government stance about all these reports going around?
Yes, these are the people we are accusing to be spoiling the relationship between the two countries because the attacks now come from the northern part of our country, from the Republic of Sudan, and that's why we are urging the Sudan government to be alert. We know that South Sudan is committed to have good relations with the Republic of Sudan, and we are doing everything in our power to improve that relationship. But allowing the Janjaweed and the ethnic groups like Mensaria to come and people train and well arm and attack some of our oil fields in Unity State, like what they did in Bentiu with a lot of massacre, definitely this doesn't all go well. And that's why we are urging Sudan to check its side of the border in order to enhance, to make sure that no hostile elements are allowed to come into the Republic of South Sudan and cause havoc.
Has Juba officially petitioned Khartoum about its concerns regarding some of these that you've enumerated?
No, we have not yet talked to them officially because we believe that the reason good environment between the two presidents, President Salva Kiir Mayardit and President Omar al-Bashir, that they communicate to each other. We believe that those doors are still open. I'm sure as the leadership, they will make telephone messages between themselves and try and see this, discuss some of these things so that they are put into proper order that falls in line
with the spirit of building good relations between the two countries. And I believe that South Sudan is still committed that we build our relations on good relationship. And therefore, there are other diplomatic avenues that are being used now so that this error is quickly corrected.
Barnaba Merrill Benjamin is South Sudan's foreign minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Juba. A Middle East analyst says next month's Egyptian presidential election will be a sham election because it is, in reality, a one-candidate contest. Nizar Al-Seya, chair of the University of California Berkeley's Center for Middle Eastern Studies, says the millions of Egyptians who participated in the country's successive revolutions never expected that the election would be between a military person and a relatively unknown candidate. This comes as Egypt's Presidential Elections Committee announced on Sunday that the May 26 to 27 poll will be between former Army General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and Hamdin Sabahi. Al-Seya tells me Sabahi should withdraw his candidacy to show to the world that the election will be a sham.
Basically, what you have is a situation, unfortunately, that one can say is very predictable, and a lot of people had predicted it exactly in this manner because, in a sense, this is a sham election. It's not really a real election, and there is only one candidate that one can actually talk about as a real candidate.
Why is it sham?
It is a sham election because, you know, the revolutionaries that started the revolution and the thousands, if not millions, of people who participated either in the January 25th uprising and then later in the 30th of June uprising of 2013, I'm almost certain that these people never expected that it was going to come down to a selection between a military officer and someone who just simply represents the old guard and who is simply isolated from the larger Egyptian public.
Do you think, Professor, that Mr. Sabahi should have, as some are suggesting, that he perhaps should have gotten out of the race?
Frankly, he should withdraw so as to make sure that both the Egyptian people and the rest of the world see that this is a sham election. His continuation in that race with almost guarantee that he will absolutely not win just gives some credibility to a win by Sisi, which I don't think is good for Egypt or good even for the world.
It's frightening as I read some of the articles that Sisi has become very popular to the point that Egyptians are singing songs about him at their weddings or with his pictures or on their walls.
Yes, I mean, he's become very popular, but you have to remember he's become very popular from the perspective that he is the savior. Yet at the same time, he is someone without any record of achievement whatsoever other than that.
I'm thinking perhaps Sabahi can get more votes if supporters of the former president Mohamed Morsi turn out. But it seems to me that they have banned the Muslim Brotherhood from taking part, eh?
Yes, the Muslim Brotherhood folks are banned from participating in the political process as a result of the regulations that were issued under Sisi. But for me, that's not really the real issue or the real problem. The real problem is that you have a very large percentage of the Egyptian population that is likely to totally boycott this vote. You have to remember, Sabahi is not necessarily very popular with the followers of Hosni Mubarak, nor is he popular at all with the Muslim Brotherhood, nor is he popular with the larger Egyptian public.
For the millions of Egyptians who agitated, who went in the street to protest against the Muslim Brotherhood, is this what they probably bargained for, or they are shocked or surprised?
I am absolutely certain that the leaders of both January 25th, 2011, and June 30th, 2013, are both gravely disappointed with the current political situation in Egypt. Many of their followers, whoever may not, and they are not necessarily happy with the situation, but they accept it as the reality that comes with the revolution.
Nizar Al-Seya is chairman of the University of California Berkeley's Center for Middle Eastern Studies. He was speaking with me from Berkeley, California. It's Monday morning, April 21st, and you are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 and a half minutes past the hour. The Somali government on Sunday opened a national security conference in Mogadishu. President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed told participants that the country must overcome what he called the culture of lawlessness, violence, and self-interest. Hassan Sheikh Ali Noor, who is one of the experts attending the conference, says the government is seeking public consultation by holding the conference.
The purpose of this conference is to to get back to Somalia's security and prosperity, and to eliminate all sources of insecurity at the society level.
So explain to me the agenda of the conference. What are you trying to achieve?
The agenda of the conference is consultation between the society and the state. For the Somali state, security were dominated by the regime. So now this government come out with the new ideas to ask the people what your views and what your security interest and the government expected from the society to give ideas and the views on the better future for the Somali generation.
How is the conference going to deal with the current security challenge in the country?
The Somali government is facing numerous challenges, including security threats, but not only the security threat. There is a misunderstanding between the state and society. The lack of understanding, the security itself, the mistrust among the clans or the societies of the regions. So this conference is not only to focus on the security issues, but bigger than that, or the comprehensive security, and the state or the government were trying to ask the input from the society in order to overcome the numerous challenges, including for security threats.
But what about the threat that is coming from Al-Shabaab that is currently blocking the government to expand its authority to the rest of the country?
That threat you mentioned exists and nobody can deny it, but that threat exists because there is a lack of state-society connection. And then now the state asking the society to work with the state security institutions in order to overcome that insecurity.
Hassan Sheikh Ali Noor, who is one of the experts attending a security conference, was speaking with Haroon Maruf of VOA Somali Service. Malawian President Joyce Banda says she will win re-election on May 20th, despite calls for her resignation because of allegations that she personally benefited from the so-called Cashgate corruption scandal, in which $30 million of public funds were allegedly stolen in 2013. In an interview with the Interpress Service, the president said she has done everything possible to take on corruption in her country. Presidential Press Secretary Stephen Mshane tells me President Banda is confident of winning re-election because her policies and programs resonate with Malawians.
She's confident because she has the support of the people, whether the programs and the policies resonate with what people would like to see. I think that's what is making her confident that she's going to win.
Of course, she says that she inherited an economy that was bad, but now she thinks that she has put the economy in order. Give me an example of what she has done to put the economy in order.
Yes, she inherited an economy that was on the brink of collapse. At that time, the country was able to import fuel, for example. People were sleeping at filling stations looking for fuel. But immediately she came to power, she solved that problem, and she has turned that around. And right now, there's no problem to do with fuel. The economy itself, when she became president, grew at 1.8% during the first year that she was in office in 2013. The economy expanded by 6%. There are so many other things. Companies were closing down or were downsizing. Actually, they were operating at the manufacturing industry, for example, was operating at 30%. But she has turned that around, and now companies are operating at over 35%. And these are the things that these are the consequences.
Of course, Stephen, you know that the president continued to be haunted by this cash gate. And I think here she is really fighting back when she's asked whether her administration has done enough to get to the bottom of the cash gate. Has she done enough?
The president has done enough, not just the president, but the president and her government has put in place an action plan to fight corruption in the country. The cash gate issue is not a new thing in Malawi. Before she came to power, government lost 92 billion Malawi kwacha when her predecessor was in power. When she came to power, 6 billion was discovered or diluted, and she moved quickly with her government to put in place an action plan to get to the bottom of the problem. Several people have been arrested. Bank accounts have also been frozen for those who have been suspected of leaking the government coffers.
In the fight against corruption, the president seemed to be suggesting that she's fighting against what she called powerful and influential people. Is this the case?
I think what she has been saying is that almost all the time when you're fighting against people who are suspected to be corrupt, they'll fight back because they want to prove to be innocent.
Stephen Mchane is press secretary to Malawian President Joyce Banda. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The family of the late former chairman of Liberia's last transitional government has released a statement which includes what they say are his wishes. Judy Bryan, who led Liberia's sixth interim government from October 2013 to January 2006 and played a key role in guiding the country from civil war to the election of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, died April 16th. At the John F. Kennedy Medical Center in Monrovia after a protracted illness. In a statement released Sunday in Monrovia, the family said it was Brian's wish that there should be no government-sponsored function over his remains. Councillor Pearl Brown Bull is a former member of Liberia's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. She tells me the family feels the late Brian did not get any proper treatment from the government when he was alive.
A statement from the Carr and Bryant family stated that it was a wish of former Chairman Bryant that there will be no 21-gun salute, there will be no gazette, and there will be no panegyric.
The question is, one would think that the family would accept a state funeral because he led a transitional government. Why do you think it was the wish of the former chairman or the late Judy Bryan to make this his wish?
As a lawyer in my own right and as a politician, I feel that it's right for the family to carry out his wishes because for two reasons. Either one, he could have been frustrated, disenchanted, and disappointed with the manner in which, for some reason, this government disappointed him that it didn't treat him in the manner as a former head of state. In the actions, in the dealings, the statements, and the mannerism.
Councillor Bull, I'm looking through the statement that was issued by the Judy Bryan family. In nowhere did it mention the Liberian government. It says here, the people of Liberia, the international community, including the United Nations, the African Union, and ECOWAS, may pay tributes at the wake-keeping ceremony on Friday, May 9th. It did not say the Liberian government. Was it deliberate?
They are carrying on the wish of Chairman Bryant. And Chairman Bryan was in his sound mind up to 50 minutes before he died because he had called his lawyer, Councillor Frank Musa-Dean, to his office in his home, and he was in his office. He had given him instructions to sue the National Port Authority under the leadership of Ms. Matilda Parker for reneging on a contract. He did it. There were three persons who bid it, and he won. So maybe Chairman Bryan felt that they didn't give him the respect. He served the country, and he went for a purpose. He served with humility. He was a super man. And so that's why he just wanted to be remembered only in that manner. History will judge him. And although his heart stopped, and his children do no longer have their father and his family, but those who still have living hearts, their conscience will be their guide.
Councillor Pearl Brown Bull is a former member of Liberia's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. She was speaking with me from Liberia's capital, Monrovia. All attempts to get an official of the Liberian government to commit failed. French filmmaker Luc Jacques won world acclaim for his 2005 Academy Award-winning documentary, March of the Penguins. Now Jacques is back with a new film that takes moviegoers deep into the heart of a tropical rainforest, not only to celebrate its grandeur, but to make the case for its survival. Roseanne Scurbo reports.
Once Upon a Forest opens in the crown of a giant Moabi tree in Gabon's Congo River Basin. Famed French botanist Francis Hallet purchased on a branch drawing. He and Jacquette spent 5 months in Gabon and Peru to make the film. Jacquette learned what Hallet had been preaching for decades, that trees have their own way to be alive.
When you go in this kind of thinking, you discover a new universe. It's interesting because at that point, you begin to start to think that this is not the animals who are the kings of the forest. This is The trees are the king of the forest.
Jacquette films the life story of a rainforest, where natural events unfold over hundreds of years. He speeds up the timeline by mixing live action with Halle's animated drawings.
We are beginning from zero, and we are going to cross the centuries with the trees to see the trees and the forest in a different way. To be clear between what I'm able to see and what I imagine.
Every plant and every animal in the forest is intimately connected. Jacquette says trees keep this growing and changing family in balance with a shared language.
We know that trees are not talking with words, they are talking with scents. And they are able to mix this scents like words to make a text. And they are able to exchange message. They are able to modify the behavior of animals with this substance.
Jacquette deploys teams of naturalists and photographers to capture these subtle scenes. And where he can't go, he sends in small drones. He says walking the hallowed grounds and following the daily rituals tap into what it means to be human.
That's VOA Roseanne Scurble reporting. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Mauritania upstaged their hosts Mauritius 2-0 in the return leg of their 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations preliminary in Curepipe on Sunday. Mauritania advanced on a 3-0 aggregate and, together with South Sudan, progressed to the main draws for the Nations Cup to be conducted in Cairo, Egypt next week. Meanwhile, in an all-Malian encounter, AS Real de Bamako pipped Joliba 2-1 in Bamako as Egypt's El Ahly edged Morocco's Difa El Jadida 1-0 and Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa pipped South Africa's Kaizer Chiefs 2-1 in Orange Africa Confederations Cup action on Sunday. Elsewhere, Congo Brazzaville's AC Leopards dismissed Ghana's Medeama 2-0. Cameroon's Cotton Sport pipped Angola's Petro Atletico 2-1. Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports beat Nigeria's Bayelsa United 2-0. Guinea's Horoya and Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel drew 0-0, as did Zambia's Nkana and Tunisia's Bizertin. In Namibia, Ghana's under-17 side dismissed their South African peers 3-0 to win the round-robin Four Nations tournament in Swakopmund. German side Westphalia is second with 6 points, followed by Namibia, then South Africa. Elsewhere, Malawi's under-20 side pipped their South African hosts 1-0 in their second friendly over the weekend played in Soweto. They earlier drew 1-1. Turning to athletics, Nigeria won the women's 4x400-meter relay at the Mount San Antonio College International Meet in Los Angeles, California State, USA on Saturday. The quartet of Shade Abugan, Omolara Omotoso, Bukola Abugunloko, and Regina Jacobs clocked a winning time of 3 minutes and 28.78 seconds, the fastest time in the world in the event this year. Kenyan Elvin Kibet won the women's 10,000 meters in 32 minutes and 40.22 seconds. Nigerian African champion Ame Chin Morton was third in the 400-meter hurdles, as was Stephen Mosier in the shot put. Nigeria placed third in the men's 4x100-meters and 4x400-meter relays. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Have a great day. And that's it for this Monday, April 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you in Africa will make this week a very productive one. Stay tuned for International Edition next on The Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.